Jim, aren't all librarians magic?
Yes.
I've worked it as one off and on, and I've always thought they were magic.
The librarian in the recent books might be a more literal form of magic, but yeah, librarians are amazing. You know, I hung out with some of the library students when I was in grad school, and they were wonderful, creative people who always kicked my butt at Trivial Pursuit. It was humbling. And then as I've gotten older, you know, just the services we get at the local library, just not only books and movies and audiobooks, but, you know, taking my kids, taking them to some of the activities, it's just amazing. They are a wonderful public service, and I cannot say enough.
Well, it makes sense to me that you would use librarians in this magical fantasy series. For our listeners, can you describe what a Libriomancer is? Am I pronouncing that right?
You've got it right. A Libriomancer is basically there's someone who can reach into a book and pull things out of the pages. There are some rules to it. Whatever you pull out has to fit through the physical book. So I can't get a Star Wars tie-in novel and pull out an X-Wing. Likewise, there are certain books that have been locked up because they're considered to be just too dangerous, which means the One Ring from Lord of the Rings is off limits. But Libriomancers like Isaac can run around pulling out healing potions, lightsabers, magical items, all sorts of fun stuff. And the more you've read, the more options you have.
So your new book is Revisionary, which is the fourth in a series. Give us a little background on the series and what readers can expect in this newest. Is it the final in the series?
Number four is the last book, yes.
So if you can, kind of a little synopsis of what the series is.
Well, the books start with Libriomancer. And the central character is Isaac Vainio. He is a librarian from the Upper Peninsula, and he is a Libriomancer who at the start of the series has gotten himself into trouble, and he's kind of been put in magical timeout. But over the course of the series, well, it's magic, so things go wrong. Various things get loose, including, well, I don't want to spoil that, but there are some things from the past, from the history of magic, that pop up again. And the other piece that I wanted to deal with is so many urban fantasy books and series have the assumption that magic exists, but it's a secret.
Mm.
And I look around at how well we as a species keep secrets, and I just have a really hard time believing we would be able to hide this. We're not that good.
Yeah.
So over the course of the four books, the secret starts to come out and the world starts to recognize, oh, hey, there's some weird stuff going on. You know, and maybe you could have covered it up 20 years ago, but now everybody's got iPhones, everything's on YouTube. So by the time book four comes around, this is where magic is fully out in the open. And we're seeing different nations, different societies, just trying to cope with this revelation, with what does this mean? How does this change things? What do we do now? Isaac is a total geek, and he has always been a geek about magic. And all he really wants to do is research and find new magic, and we can help the planet, and we can colonize Mars. He's almost the living embodiment of that Lego song, Everything is Awesome. Unfortunately, there are people who are, you know, more selfish or want to use magic for more personal reasons. And this causes all sorts of conflicts over the course of the fourth book. So Isaac is struggling to try and balance out, how do I do this? How do I celebrate magic? How do I protect it? How do I protect us as a people? It pushes him into a much more responsible position that he is not necessarily ready for.
It seems to me that when you're working on not just one book, but an entire series like this, you have got to have some really elaborate outlines that you work from just to keep all of this straight.
You would think so.
And do you plan out the whole series or do you go book at a time?
A little of both. I did have some loose plans for the Libriomancer series. I knew where I wanted to get to. I knew that over the course of the series, the secret would come out. I knew Isaac would be moving into a more responsible position in the magical society. They're called the Porters. Mm-hmm. The details I was a lot less clear about. It's more a loose... If you describe it as a map,
okay.
I knew where I was starting. I knew the end point, and I had a couple of spots marked along the way that, hey, I want to go visit here. But I did not plan out every exit, every detour,
okay.
All of that stuff.
I'm wondering, too, there was something when I was thinking about talking with you today, and I thought, why is it that in particular genres like fantasy, which is yours, as well as sci-fi, we tend to expect series, long series of books, which doesn't necessarily at all hold true for other types of fiction. Why is that?
Oh, that's a good question.
We get these wonderful characters and we don't want to let go?
That's a piece of it, yeah. And some of it is a marketing publishing thing. In a lot of respects, series can sell better because you put book one out, people buy it. Maybe a year later, you put book two out and it sends another batch of people to pick up book one. And so the publisher says, yay. Like you said, people get very invested. They want to know more about the characters. They want to know more about the world. If you look back at Harry Potter, it wasn't the first book that really took off. Probably about three of them had come out. And that's when, at least to my memory, I remember everybody was suddenly talking about this. Everybody had to rush out and buy them. Starting with book four, we had more of the midnight releases. There was this exponential increase in fans and readers and excitement. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes people look, oh, book two is out. Well, I never read book one, so I'll just pass by the whole thing. But I think a lot of it is an attempt to duplicate what Harry Potter did so well, to just continue building that audience, building that enthusiasm. And the other piece is... it makes it easier to tell bigger stories. With the Libriomancer books, each book is self-contained, but I also wanted to tell this bigger story about Isaac's evolution and about some of the secondary characters, like Lena Greenwood, who is the kick-ass dryad fighter woman, and she changes a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, watching her come into her own was not something I could do in one book.
And there was a concept in there that I had to wonder if you were tapping into something that's going on in contemporary society today. Isaac's own government incarcerates these people in prisons and internment camps. And we've been talking about that in today's political scenario, Guantanamo and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you tend to look at what's going on today when you come up with conflicts to address in your fantasy worlds?
Not necessarily. But as I was writing this one and trying to think about, you know, how will people react? What are they going to do? How will they deal with not only these people who have magic, but these people who aren't human, werewolves, vampires, sirens. There's a lot of different species that, you know, we're having a hard enough time dealing with people who look a little different. They have a different skin color. They have a different religion. They come from a different country.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to deal with people who breathe water or drink blood or any of that? It wasn't the government as a whole necessarily, but there were definitely elements that were scared, that were angry, or that looked at these people and saw them as potential weapons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that does map up against a lot of what we're doing today, you know, where we're looking and we're scared and we're angry and we're repeating some of the same patterns we've seen in the past.
Another contemporary issue that it strikes me you do a wonderful job of addressing in many of your works, and you mentioned
Thank
this
you.
Earlier, is butt-kicking action heroines. You address sexism in your worlds that you build. And I think that's something that certainly now we're looking at a female nominee for the presidency. So this is a big topic today, and rightfully so. What got you so interested in, and you must have daughters at home as well. You've also got a series, the Princess series, which deals
yes.
with some of that. So what's behind that, Jim? Because there's not many men who address that. So kudos to you.
Thank you. Although it doesn't necessarily feel like something that deserves kudos. It's more acknowledging that, yes, women are people and they can be competent and strong and strong in a lot of different ways. It's not just that one sort of narrow, we can have a strong female, but it's got to be Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah.
No, there's range, there's variety, just like any other group of people. One of the things that I try to be conscious of, I mean, I grew up in this culture. I grew up with assumptions and stereotypes and beliefs that got ingrained in my head that I'm continuing to try and be aware of and try and clean up.
Mm-hmm.
But like in the Princess series, in the Magic Ex Libris series, is putting in more than just that one token strong female character. I mean, you have Lina, who is just a lot of fun, although problematic in ways.
Mm-hmm.
She does. She kicks butt. She is stronger than most about anything out there. She is very competent with her swords, and she's a dryad, so she can do all these neat tricks with wood. You've also got Nithi Shaw, who does not have magic. She is a psychiatrist who is having to try and deal with some of these magic people, and most of these magic-using people are just nuts, so she's got her work cut out for her. But watching her using her own skills and knowledge, she can hold her own against pretty much anybody out there. And I love seeing that.
Yeah.
The Princess series was, I do have a daughter, and she was going through that fairy tale princess phase. And I wasn't going to tell her, no, you can't watch Disney. You can't watch these Barbie movies. But I wanted to put some more stories out there where the princesses were the heroes of their own stories. Where
not
Snow
just
White
getting and, married happily ever after.
Right. Snow White and Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella team up and they rescue the prince and they fight the witch. And then Red Riding Hood is trying to assassinate Sleeping Beauty in a later book. And just letting them be the heroes and be the core of the story. And I loved those three princesses. I loved those women. They were all imperfect.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they were human. But together, they were such a wonderful team and family to write about. And I got a little pushback on those books. I would occasionally get, yeah, I would get like reviews or comments that, you know, this is nice and all, but Jim, you didn't write like any male characters. You know, the only guys in here are all shoved into the background. And I just sat there thinking, gosh, gee, I wonder what that must be like to have your whole gender swept aside to make way for, yeah.
Oh, thank you, Jim. See, I love it. I love it. Tough, tough princesses. And then you've had some fun with the Muppets as well. I like the way you take classic stuff out there and just give it a twist.
Yes, that was a short story. It's actually linked on my website if anybody wants to read it. It's basically a parody of Sesame Street with werewolves.
Mm.
When I wrote it, it was right around Thanksgiving. And we were going over to my family, my parents, my brother, all of that. And I hand this story to my brother to just, you know, read this. Tell me what you think before I send it in. And he reads it and he turns around with this horrified expression on his face when he's done. And it says, "What is wrong with you?" Which told me I had pretty much done what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
It was just fun and completely twisted and all of it came about because my son, who was much younger at the time, was constantly watching these shows, and I was staring at the computer, and we had Sesame Street in the background again. Mm-hmm. And I wanted an excuse to write a scene where Elmo completely loses his mind and blows away another Muppet, and he's stuffing everywhere. It's gruesome. And it just, it was so much twisted fun.
Story time at your house must be great fun.
It depends. Either fun or sometimes a little messed up.
I wonder what your thoughts might be on, and tell us a little bit on how you developed an interest in fantasy writing. I've got to think that somewhere in your childhood, and for you and other creatives, other writers and people who really use their imagination in their careers, there's got to be some time, in quotations, boredom, where you fill it with imagination. And I wonder, too, about today's younger generations. Are we giving them enough time to get bored? In other words, are we giving them enough time to develop imagination?
Oh, more good questions. Well, starting with me, I wouldn't necessarily say bored, but there was definitely that drive for the imagination and to find that sense of wonder and possibility and what if. And fantasy and science fiction, that has been at the heart of so much of the history there, is just asking, well, what if we could do this? And then running and imagining it and playing in those worlds to see what comes next. Mm-hmm. And I've loved doing that for as long as I can remember. I actually just got back from a week-long workshop in Wyoming, the Launchpad Astronomy Workshop. Mm-hmm. And we were all talking about, we were the readers. We were the ones who got so absorbed in these stories as kids, whether it was reading or watching Star Trek on TV, but all of that possibility, all of that sense of wonder. And I think pretty much everybody there talked about it at one point.
When you say it wasn't necessarily boredom, I can really relate to that because I don't feel like I've ever gotten bored. It's a void that we leave an empty space for a child or an adult to fill. And sometimes I wonder, with technology and constant entertainment and the busy schedules that we give our younger generations, are we giving them enough of a void to fill?
That's a great way of thinking about it. I don't know if I would say void, but giving them quiet.
Yeah.
Giving them of that almost stillness to just... I don't know the answer to that. I know there's been some research about electronics and video screens and how much is too much and what sort of video stuff can be helpful and what sort is damaging. Looking at my own kids, I mean, there's the ideal version where we will schedule everything and it will all be perfect according to the latest psychological research. There's the reality of, well, sometimes I need to vacuum the house and work on a story for a deadline and do six other things, and my kid's going to watch his iPad for a little while. Mm-hmm. But I think at least being aware of that, trying to make sure the kids have other options. And another piece of that is, you know, kids learn by watching grownups. Mm-hmm. If the grownups are always on their phones, always in front of a screen, then of course that's what the kids are going to do. But if the grown-ups are stopping to read, or you're reading together, or, you know, you have, even just having books in the house, I have another writer friend of mine who talks about going over to a friend's house as a kid and being so confused because where were the books?
Yeah.
Because this other house just didn't have any. I mean, I don't think we all need the kind of libraries that most writers will have, because we tend to border on being hoarders in that respect. But having those stories, reading to the kids at bedtime, buying them when they come home from school with the book order forms, even if it's just a couple of things from that little Scholastic booklet, and then making sure you're reading too.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much out there. And also, you know, selfishly, those of us who write for a living want to keep making a living at it.
We're not supposed to judge books by their covers, but this kind of goes hand in hand with the sexism topic that we talked about here earlier. You've done some interesting work with poorly designed covers. Unfortunately, this is radio and we can't have a picture, but...
Oh, if anybody really wants to see them, those are also on my website under the cover poses link. And I wouldn't necessarily say poorly designed. More, a lot of the cover art I had been noticing years ago, women were getting shoved into this narrow range of dress and posing and all of that. And it's not a new trend or anything like that.
No.
But, you know, we talked a little bit about the strong women characters, and it felt like, okay, urban fantasy, we can have the Buffy the Vampire Slayer character, but when we do the cover art, she's going to be contorted to best display her butt, her chest, basically she's sexualized.
Right.
And she is put on there more as an object than as a character. And that's all we were seeing again and again and again. So I was thinking about writing a blog rant about this, as one does, and instead decided to ask my wife if she could take some pictures of me trying to duplicate these poses, which ended up going kind of viral and being much more popular than I had expected it to. I did, I think, 4 series of cover photos, just trying to address the different ways women are sexualized and to make it really obvious.
It wasn't very comfortable, was it?
It was physically painful.
There you go.
there were some of these poses that I needed to go see a chiropractor afterwards. But you see something so many times, you stop seeing it.
Right.
And putting this middle-aged white dude into some of these poses, suddenly you saw it again.
Yeah.
You might not want to, but you know, it made it hard to ignore.
So I love the way you use humor to wake people up to certain things.
I try. You know, humor makes everything better.
Yeah.
Almost everything.
There's a serious thing that you do, too, also on your website, that you take some involvement in rape cases as a crisis counselor, and you've also written about that. So we've got this website of fantasy and humor and tough princesses, but then you've got these serious resources. What inspired you to, and I've got to think there's a connection there too. What inspired you to address that tough topic?
Like you said, I used to work as a crisis counselor and a rape counselor. I'm not doing that anymore, but put in some years volunteering at a center in East Lansing. I worked for the domestic violence shelter on MSU's campus for a little while. And it's something I've been aware of for probably about 25 years now, ever since a friend of mine in early high school talked to me about having been raped. Mm. And it's another one of those things that the more you become aware, the more you open your eyes and look around, the more you see just how prevalent and epidemic sexual assault, sexual violence are in this culture and in this society.
Yeah.
And for a while, I didn't have that on my website. I was thinking, oh no, I'm trying to be a professional author now. I should keep everything author focused and build my brand or something. I don't know, marketing, brainwashing speak. But I got to thinking about it more, and I've reached the point where I get hundreds or thousands of people coming to my website every day, you know, coming to read the blog or coming to check out the books or coming to read about Muppet werewolves. And statistically, hundreds of those people have been victims of sexual violence.
Yeah.
And just putting something out there to say, even just, hey, you're not alone. This is not your fault. there are some resources out there. There are people you can talk to, and you're not alone. Even that little bit can make a huge difference.
Yeah.
And just trying to get to generate a bit more awareness, to get people to realize that, yes, this is a problem. It's a problem we can do stuff about.
Mm-hmm.
But so many people, we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to acknowledge it. Like the case in the news right now about the swimmer from, I think, Stanford.
Right, right.
We're so worried about, well, what about his reputation? Well, maybe she did something wrong too. And maybe there's all this mm-hmm. victim blaming and second guessing and protecting the perpetrator. And we talk about, well, we don't want to punish him because she made a bad choice. It's like, well, no, she was asleep. You can't make a choice when you're asleep. The person exactly. who made the bad choice was the one who made the choice to rape someone who was asleep.
Yeah.
And yet people are still arguing about it. People are still defending this guy. And yes, I get angry and passionate about this stuff.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us, Jim. I've got to tell you, I've got two very little granddaughters growing up, and when they get a little older, I hope to introduce them to the Princess series. So keep writing about those empowered women. You're doing a good service for girls and women.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.